We are frequently reminded of the reality of death, that it surrounds us, that it is a great enemy. Currently in the Sunday Minneapolis newspaper is a series of articles that deals with death and research concerning it. We well know that the focus of the nation today is on the death of Senator Hubert Humphrey, and therefore also targeted in upon our state of Minnesota. At this very hour, a memorial service in Washington, D.C. is being held for Senator Humphrey, the prime speaker, the eulogy being given by the President of the United States. So that even if we would like to escape reminders of our vulnerability in matters of life and death, we cannot. We face questions concerning it. We're asked by others. We struggle with these things ourselves. What would you do if someone, a long and dear friend, someone that you knew well, a man who was a Christian, who had long walked with the Lord, were to come to you and seek your counsel, saying that there was at least the possibility, no, he admitted it, the probability, that before this year would come to its conclusion, his wife would die, that he was questioning how he would face that very difficult time, struggling with perhaps the concern that in facing this, he would fall apart. He wouldn't respond to the struggle as he ought. And perhaps his Christian testimony would be compromised, that maybe some would say, where is his Christ? Why isn't he holding up under the problems and the stress? He's not facing anything any different than others have faced. How would you answer someone that asks what he should do, how he should respond, or how these kinds of fears ought to be relieved? It's not a simple question. It's very complex, very difficult. And probably you would respond as I would respond, not so much saying certain propositions as rather trying to point to some models and say, well, I know someone who went through what you may go through. I know someone who's been where you are. And maybe if we've experienced those troubled waters ourselves, we'll say, you know, it wasn't too many years ago when I thought the thoughts that you are thinking, and I verbalized the words that you have spoken. We point people to models. We like to say, there was a woman of faith. There was a man who walked with God, and he also, knowing God as you know him, faced the crisis that you faced. And this is how he did it. That's the kind of thing we do when we point again to that man of faith, Abraham. Genesis 23 tells the story of his facing the death of his beloved, of facing a crisis. And out of his experience, we learn that we, as people of faith like Abraham, can exercise that faith even in the midst of crisis. Abraham in Genesis 23 exhibits three characteristics of the man of faith in the time of crisis. The first is that the man of faith experiences human emotions. Genesis 23 begins with these first two verses. Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. The man of faith. He had deep roots of emotion. Abraham did. He had a fine wife. And I would suppose that there is no greater gift that God can give a man than a fine wife. The scriptures say that her price is far above rubies. And of the best, Sarah would have to be described as amongst the most excellent. She was a beautiful woman, exceedingly beautiful, to the point that men desired her even when she was late in life, when she was an elderly woman. But she was also her own person, her own woman. She walked in her integrity with a distinctive individualism. She was characterized as being spirited and intelligent and decisive, even feisty. She was a woman also, though, amidst all of that individualism and that spunkiness, who had an unwavering loyalty and love and devotion and obedience to her husband, to the point where we can frankly say, critically say, that she was loyal to him virtually to a fault. When he would tell her to lie and do things she ought not do, she would do them. Even though that was true, the Bible describes her not only as beautiful, not only as a strong individual, not only as having unwavering loyalty to her husband, but also as a godly person, a deeply spiritual woman. So that the Apostle Peter could write in 1 Peter 3:6 that she is the spiritual mother of us all. That's quite a statement. She was quite a person, a unique woman before God. To the best of my recollection, she is the only woman in all of Scripture who has the age at death recorded. Now you remember, the Bible comes out of an Oriental culture where women did not have a high place in society. And therefore, even though there are scores of men whose name and age at death is recorded, Sarah's unique. She stands alone, the only one whose age at death is given. It's quite a relationship they had. They were old, very old. Abraham, at the time his spouse died, was 137 years old. She was 127 years old. They lived a long time, most of that time together. We don't know exactly how old they were when they were married, but they had been married probably close to 100 years. Now, there aren't too many people that do that. And you imagine going to the local Hallmark card store in Mamrie and trying to get a 100-year anniversary card, and they're hard to get. What do you buy somebody for a 100th anniversary? I remember a few years ago, one of my brothers, who's a pastor in New Jersey, went and was asked to give a prayer at a 50th wedding anniversary celebration. And sometimes he gets carried away. He was really excited by the occasion. In the course of the prayer, he evoked God's blessing and said, "Oh, Lord, give them another 50 years of marital bliss together," you know. And brought him out to about 140 years old by the next time they celebrated. Well, for Abraham and Sarah, it was a long time. But the point is that they had spent most of life together. They had had the ups and the downs, you know, the valleys and the peaks. Their lives had had problems, but their lives had had tremendous victories. They had experienced God's touch through good times and through bad times. They had experienced, perhaps most beautifully of anybody described in the Bible, the specialness of that union relationship that God desires for his people, in the best sense of the term. And so maybe it's somewhat unexplainable that when we read, particularly in the King James Version of the Bible, which gives a little better rendering of the verb structure of these verses, that apparently Abraham was away when his wife died. It says that he came to mourn her. He was a wealthy man. He had a lot of possessions, a lot of herds. Perhaps he was out checking them, visiting some of his employees, traveling, some type of a business venture. But it must have added to the hurt and the hollowness of that hurt that he wasn't there at the moment that she died, after they had been together so much and for so very long. Yeah, there were deep roots of emotion. And so it's no wonder that there was a deep expression of emotion. Abraham came to mourn for Sarah, to weep for her. The Hebrew verb most literally says he came to lament, to wail, to cry out at the loss, the emptiness, because of the death of one that he loved. Well, it wasn't that Abraham didn't know that sooner or later this would happen. They were old. Perhaps he thought that because he was 10 years her senior that maybe he would die first. But he knew, he must have known, that there was at least the possibility that she would be the first to die. Or it wasn't that he had lost his faith in God. He wasn't saying that God had forsaken him. That wasn't why he was crying. That wasn't why there was this lament. No, none of that. But rather that Abraham felt the deep and the inevitable emotions of losing someone whom he dearly and deeply loved and had dearly and deeply loved for a lifetime. As believers, sometimes, I think many times, we are reluctant to express the depth of emotion. Sometimes when we're in the hospital room, or we're facing the crisis, or we've lost a job, or someone we love dies, or we're in a medical difficulty, sometimes we think, you know, you've got to sort of stifle that expression of emotion. You can't let people see it, because somehow Christian testimony might be compromised. People might say, you know, really, what kind of a Christian is that? I mean, why does she cry? Why does he lose his cool? Why? I thought they were Christians. Why are they so different? Well, sometimes then, because we are afraid that we will not express a difference, sometimes we're afraid that our testimony won't show through. So we try to bolster ourselves up and fabricate something that says those emotions ought not be shown. But when we do that, we forget that men and women of faith, people like Abraham, expressed their emotions and expressed them openly, that they weren't afraid to recognize that God who created them created within them the openness to that type of expression, that it was God who expressed through that creative act the opportunity and the facilities for laughter and for sorrow, for grief and for celebration. I recall now, a lot of years ago, my wife and I attended a funeral, and it was sort of a strange funeral. It was held in the church building at night, and so it was well attended. The man who died was a prominent member of the community, well known in the church and well known through the area. The funeral was designed to be a celebration, and I don't oppose that. I think there's good theology for that. But there was something strange about it. The family, they were dressed like an Easter Sunday morning service. They were dressed in jubilant colors. There were no tears. There was more laughter. All of the music, everything was kind of upbeat. There was no expression of sorrow or grief, no display of emotions that seemed to communicate that someone dearly beloved had died. They were concerned, and rightly concerned. I don't criticize them for that. Concerned that a Christian testimony show through. But it wasn't too many weeks until that widow began to fall apart. Until the sorrow broke through the surface. Until it was there, it could be held back no more. And then somehow accentuating and multiplying it, perhaps, was the feeling of guilt that the sorrow ought not have ever occurred. Never be afraid of emotions in the midst of crises. In fact, in many ways, I believe that as Christians who have been blessed by God with depths of relationships that non-Christians can never know, we experience an emotional response that non-Christians cannot express. Because God has blessed us so deeply, we feel the loss of God's blessing and those that we love more deeply than others. Abraham, the man of faith, experienced human emotions. It was a second experience which characterized him in crisis. It's described in verses 3 to 16. Here we see that the man of faith demonstrates proper behavior. The verses say like this: Abraham arose up from before his dead, and he said to the Hittites, "I'm a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me property among you for a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight." The Hittites answered Abraham, "Hear us, my lord. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our sepulchres. None of us will withhold from you a sepulchre or hinder you from burying your dead." Abraham rose and bowed to the Hittites, the people of the land. And he said to them, "If you are willing that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and entreat for me Ephron, the son of Zohar, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns. It is the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence as a possession for a burying place." Now Ephron was sitting among the Hittites. And Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the Hittites, of all who went in at the gate of the city. He said, "No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead." Then Abraham bowed down before the people of the land. He said to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, But if you will hear me, I will give you the price of the field. Accept it from me, that I may bury my dead there." Ephron answered Abraham, "My lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that between you and me? Bury your dead." Abraham agreed with Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver, which he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weights current among the merchants. I'm concerned that we see the way Abraham held together and functioned through the time of crisis, because it reflects the walk with God which he had as a man of faith. You see, Abraham had a clarity of perspective in his calling from God. Do you notice the first words that he speaks, at least of record, after this mourning time? It's in verse 4. He says, "I'm a sojourner. I'm a temporary resident here." Now, the immediate implication of that seems to be he's really a Chaldean and not a Canaanite. In other words, he was born farther east in the Fertile Crescent, and he moved there. But that isn't what he was saying. To really understand what he was saying, we need to flip through the Bible to later on, to Hebrews chapter 11. I'd like you to look at that with me for just a minute. Hebrews 11 verses 8 through 10 give a commentary on these verses. Hebrews 11, 8 to 10 say, "By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place which he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was to go. By faith, Abraham sojourned in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise." Verse 10 is crucial. "For he looked forward to the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God." Abraham had his citizenship papers figured out that he was neither a Chaldean nor a Canaanite. He was a citizen of heaven. And that totally affected his ordering of priorities and his thinking through of his relationship with everything else, just as it ought for us. We ought not think of ourselves primarily as Minnesotans or as Americans, but primarily as citizens of heaven. And then that flavors the way we relate to all of the experiences of life. That flavors the way we see smashed up car fenders, or ill health, or job problems, or marital difficulties, or concerns with our children, even death. Everything is seen a little bit differently when we see that our primary tie is not here and now, but rather that our primary tie, our ultimate destination, is where our real citizenship is. And that is in the city that God has made. The founder, the maker, is God, that our citizenship is in heaven. He spoke of that. Maybe they didn't fully understand what he was saying, but it was clear in Abraham's mind. Well, it's out of that context that he had the base for which he could behave, even though he was under the pressure of great bereavement. And so he behaved with courtesy. He went through a series of Oriental customs, and it's kind of funny for us as Westerners to evaluate what happened here. It was sort of a negotiating session. Abraham said to these leaders of the Hittites, "I'd like to have a place to bury my wife." And apparently he didn't own land there. And he even had a place in mind. But he went according to the Oriental custom, and that is he didn't go directly to Ephron, the guy that owned the field and the cave that he wanted to use as a burial place. They frequently went through intermediaries. They used intermediaries as a part of their culture. And so he says, "I'd like to have the land." And Ephron, the Hittite, says, "You don't have to buy it. You can have it. It's yours. Just take it." Now, he didn't mean this, but that was supposed, that was what he was supposed to say, too. Sort of like we do in our culture a lot of times. Several years back, I went to a rehearsal dinner before a wedding that I was in. I was in college, and I remember a conversation. I was sitting there. I was dumbstruck, and what they said was another part of the country, and I guess it's part of the culture of that part of the country. This one woman walked in, she had a beautiful dress on. Another woman walked in and said, "My, what a lovely dress you have." And she said, "Well, thank you. Do you really like it?" She said, "Yes, I really like it." She said, "Oh, well, then I'll have to let you wear it sometime." She said, "Oh, I just love to wear your dress." In the first place, she never would have let the other woman touch her dress. In the second place, if she had let her, she never would have done it. And, that was sort of what they say there. In that part of the country. And, sort of the ritual of what you go through. And that's what they were going through. Abraham says, "I'd like to have a piece of land." Ephron says, "Hey, that's my piece of land. You can have it."
You can't have it. You can have it. And Abraham comes back and he indicates, yeah, that he would not like to just take it, which is what he was supposed to say. He'd like to buy it. So Ephron says, oh, how can we do that? You know, how could I let land that's worth, just a minute here. Let's see. So plus inflation, that would be 10%. How could I let 400 shekels stand between the two of us? We're friends. That's nothing. And he was very careful that he chose a very high price to mention what that piece of land in that cave was worth. And then the next thing Abraham was supposed to do was say, okay, well, I'll give you 200. And they're supposed to go back and forth. But that's not how Abraham responded. Even though the price was set high, and I'm sure you realize it's very difficult to talk in a different culture, a different monetary system, what this would be in our day. Some people say it would be $10,000. The point is, it was a lot of money for what was apparently a small parcel of land in a cave for burial on the side of a mountain. Abraham said, I'll pay it. Whatever it is, I'll pay it. That did a couple of things. One is it established the superiority of Abraham, that he was above that type of hassling in that situation. But even more than that, it permanently removed any question as to the possession and the rightful ownership of that piece of land. That was important. Now, if you follow the news, you realize that there have been things like this going on in our country. In Massachusetts, just a couple of weeks ago, there was a case before the federal courts concerning the Mashpee Indians. Last year, the Penobscot and the Passamaquoddy Indians had a hassle with the government of the state of Maine over land in Maine. The question of whether or not rightful transfer of ownership took place between the Indians and the settlers, whether a right price was paid, all of these things. Abraham, no, God didn't want that to happen. There was to be clear title, because you see, God had future things in mind for that land and for the environment around it. It's difficult to make proper decisions in the midst of a crisis. It's hard when someone's been bereaved to make arrangements for funerals, to make plans, to do things. When you've lost a job, when someone in your family has been physically hurt in an accident, it's hard to make decisions then. But that's where the lifestyle of walk of faith pays off, because then we can learn the lesson. We've already learned the lesson that we trust God, that even in the midst of crisis, we can trust Him with things, and He'll see to it that we're not ripped off. Even if we seem to pay too high a price, even if we seem to go too far, God allows that somehow in the mix of all those things, we can entrust Him with seeing what's best for us and what's best for Him. Giving advantage to the other guy often brings the greatest glory to God, and I believe also often brings the greatest benefit to us. Never an excuse for a believer, even in the midst of crisis, to be discourteous or unkind, or hostile, to take the advantage of another. Because as those who walk in faith, we can trust God to take care of us. The effect of all this is that both Abraham and his God were honored through it all. Let's look at the third characteristic, and that is in the closing paragraph. And that is that the man of faith looks in two directions, to the past and to the future. Verse 17 and following says, "So the field of Ephron in Machpelah, which was to the east of Mamre, the field with the cave which was in it, and all the trees that were in the field throughout the whole area, was made over to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the Hittites before all who went in at the gate of his city. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah east of Mamre," that is Hebron, "in the land of Canaan. The field and the cave that is in it were made over to Abraham as a possession for a burying place by the Hittites." Abraham kept his eye on the past. Machpelah, that's the name of the cave. That was near Mamre. Mamre was where Abraham lived. I'm sure Machpelah was a beautiful place. It was an area where oak trees grow. It was a field that had been farmed. It was on a hillside. I'm sure it was lovely. But that isn't the reason he picked it. Not because of beauty, but because of proximity to Mamre, where he lived. So that Abraham could get up every morning and he could look out on the horizon and he could see that place. So that every day he would be reminded from the sight of that place where Sarah was buried, of the journeys through which God had brought him and the blessings which God had given. He could see it from his home. Abraham wanted constantly
to be reminded of Sarah
and of this God that had given him such rich blessings. He didn't want to forget. He didn't want to forsake the past. He didn't want to start up fresh as if nothing had ever happened. For him, the past was too good, too beautiful to be forgotten. Likewise, we ought never lose sight of the past. Sometimes there's a temptation to do that in the midst of crisis. Sometimes because the past is ugly or unpleasant rather than beautiful, we want to bid farewell to it and never see it again. But we need to be reminded that it is out of the past that God builds the basis for the future. And the God who has nurtured us and cared for us, protected us, directed us even through the greatest of difficulties in bygone days, is the God who is our God of the present and of the future. So whether for you the past is beautiful or ugly, it cannot be completely forgotten, because it is the foundation upon which the present is built. So Abraham had that sight in view. But when he looked over the horizon to Machpelah, it was not only a view to the past, it was also for Abraham a sight of the future. It represented promise, because Abraham had etched within his memory the promise of God that someday, not just that piece of land he bought for 400 silver shekels, but all of the land would belong to his descendants. An impossible dream? Maybe it seemed that way to his contemporaries, but to Abraham it was rooted in that promise from God. So burial at Machpelah was Abraham's way of telling his descendants that he believed God. Later, Abraham was buried there. Leah, Rachel, Isaac, Jacob, many of his family. Later still, Machpelah, the field of Ephron, became part of the land that belonged to Abraham's descendants. When he looked to that grave, he was claiming God's promise for the future, and it was a testimony for everyone to know. Now, if my wife were to die, and I were to choose for her to be buried here in the Minneapolis area, that would be to you, to our children more importantly, a testimony that this is where our future is set, that this is our home, that this is where we plan to be for a lifetime and for generations to come. It would be a significant gesture to the future. And so it was for Abraham. You know, for his sons, he sought wives that came from Ur of the Chaldees. For Joseph, at the end of Genesis, when he died, they embalmed him. They wrapped him up in Egypt like the proverbial Egyptian mummies that we think about, and didn't bury him there permanently, but waited 400 years so that he could be buried in Canaan. But for Abraham, that was the home that God had promised. So that was the place where Sarah was buried. In the midst of the crises of life, we must keep our eye on the future also and think and act in terms of God's great promise, his promises of care, his promises of eternal life. When you face crisis on the job, in the family, at home, from the physician's lips, perhaps death, recognize that that's not the end, that that's not the time to give up, but that that is yet another opportunity for the man, the woman of faith to trust God, even in the midst of crisis. Well, don't try to fake it. Don't try to become something you're not. Don't try to hide emotions that are very real that seek to bubble to the surface. But be like Abraham, the man of faith. By God's grace, you'll handle the crisis like Abraham, experiencing human emotions, demonstrating proper behavior, looking to the past, but looking also to the future. Let's stand to pray.